Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And even Mike Pence had classified documents in his home. We have an excellent show today. Congressman Ruben Gallego tells us about his newly announced Senate run against the worst person in the world, newly independent Kyrsten Sinema. Then we'll talk to Balls and Strikes editor Jay Willis about the dystopian lawsuit against Beto O'Rourke that could give millionaires even more power over politics. But first, we have the host of Posting Through It, the Institute for Strategic Dialogues, Jared Holt. Jared Holt, Fast Politics, happy to have you here.
Yeah, good to talk again. How have you been?
The usual. I'm very conflicted about this diamond thing. She died. Trump spoke at her funeral. By the way, did you see that he truthed it was too long?
I didn't realize that he had posted that. I know he said something to that effect of like, they said 15 minutes in and out, and here I am, just stuck here.
Right, 3.5 hours. I mean, that's kind of the relatable content we crave from our electeds. Because I have been at events where I was told it was 15 minutes and it just went on and on, though it is not a great way to honor the dead.
The whole event was really weird. Like, I can't possibly imagine, dying. And then my best friend, who I make Facebook videos with, gets up there and is just like, the one world government is going to kill you with vaccines. What a way to go out. I just got to say.
Oh, man. The thing that I'm struck by is, so there were a lot of conspiracies surrounding the death of Diamond. The one that struck me as the most ridiculous was basically the idea that someone had shed the vaccine on her.
A famous thing that happens all the time.
But I mean, Will Somer had tweeted out a sort of thread of like, but they were never vaccinated, those two, right?
Allegedly. I mean, it could have been a Tucker Carlson situation, right? Where it's, you know, Tucker Carlson won't say if he got the vaccine, but I think we all know that dude is like quadruple vaxxed. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if she was vaccinated or not, but if we believe them and what they said, they were not.
I don't know that you can be unvaccinated and then still somehow try to convince your followers you died of the vaccine when your whole shtick has been anti-vax.
Yeah, I mean, they were really promoting the phrase like died suddenly.
Right.
They would pick up these instances of seemingly healthy people, athletes, younger people, I mean, just random people that were otherwise healthy, who had sudden deaths and, you know, speculating on their vaccination status. They were really big on that. And I think it is, you know, very par for the course that the grift couldn't even stop at a funeral, right? That Silk still had to go up there and in this eulogy, do the same thing. Like the funeral was content. The content train never stops. And you can't just like set aside the narratives in your content for a little bit. That's not how, you know, the Diamond and Silk Facebook page works. It's not how you get the attention of a president.
There is no world in which this ever stops. I just want to get into this for a second. Died suddenly is now an anti-vaxxer phrase.
Not in all parts of the anti-vaxxer world, but it is a very common, at the very least, we can say it's like a common sentiment, right? It's a common talking point. You know, for the last year straight, if not more, I've seen anti-vax influencers and commentators repeatedly pointing at these, you know, instances where, you know, unfortunately, a person happened to die suddenly. And, you know, kind of baselessly speculating, especially if it had to do with any kind of heart issues or anything right. like that, of the vaccine being to blame, when really, you know, the people making these kind of claims have no way of knowing that. They're just exploiting a person's death to, you know, try to make a point and try to make a buck in most cases.
Are you a little surprised that this has still gone on? Like, you know, I was thinking about this because, like, Republicans are, you know, Ron DeSantis especially, fighting against vaccine mandates, but there aren't mandates, right? Most places, you know, he's fighting against mask mandates that don't really exist.
I mean, I guess it's kind of surprising. I don't know. It's COVID was such a like unique and I think sort of red pilling moment in Republican right. politics. It was this sort of universal war drum to bang against government. And, you know, the conservative movement had been, you know, looking for something to fill that void, especially, you know, before the 2020 election, but then especially afterward. And, you know, COVID stuff, whether it's vaccinations or before that, it was mask mandates, have been really reliable in getting conservative activists to turn up places and to, you know, I assume contribute to campaigns and to get involved in different respects. So at this point, I think it's just kind of canon now. It's like something that politicians perceive as a thing that they have to acknowledge and sort of like pander to is the, you know, desires or the battle cries of people who are still obsessed with vaccines. And
right.
I guess it makes kind of sense, too. I mean, some of the rhetoric we saw around vaccines, you know, was just apocalyptic, too. And if right. you actually believe that the vaccine is like part of a New World Order conspiracy to destroy the human race, that's pretty fucking intense. I don't know what to tell yeah. you. Like, that's pretty, yeah. you know, I don't think, you know, even though these influencers, you know, probably don't believe the shit and just move on. Like, if you actually believe that, you probably don't move on from that.
Right.
And I'm sure politicians and stuff recognize that reality, at least somewhat.
No, they've definitely opened Pandora's box, and how they close it, none of them know, right? Because, I mean, this is like the problem with Trumpism, too, right? None of them, you know, they've gotten in bed with these evangelicals, but they can't get out of it. So they have, you know, they've gotten them, painted themselves into a good corner.
Yeah, and it might not even be a corner that some of them are really interested in getting out of. You know, all throughout history, inspiring fear in the masses is like a really great way to get power without having to argue that anything you're going to do is going to benefit anybody.
Right.
If you can scare the crap out of people and say, look at this terrible thing, I'm not that thing. In fact, I hate that thing too. It sounds very silly and simplistic, but historically it works. I don't know. It's kind of depressing to think about, I guess.
A bunch of Oath Keepers have now all been found guilty. I mean, it continues to be a scenario where people who were actually sort of were, you know, doing the things that they thought the Republican electeds wanted them to do are getting punished. But the Republican electeds are not.
Yeah, exactly. My colleague Eric LeVay and I just published a piece at Institute for Strategic Dialogue today that's all about accountability. And in it, we kind of make this point where, you know, these trials for seditious conspiracy against, you know, members of the Oath Keepers or members of the Proud Boys are arguably a step above the general, you know, bulk of the prosecutions the DOJ has brought against people for participating in the Capitol riot. So it's like kind of getting at the next level, but I think it's really just almost impossible to ignore that the DOJ hasn't seemed to express any sort of interest in applying that same sort of scrutiny towards the people at the top. I think that's a really common criticism of the American justice system, which is, you know, when you get high enough in American society, whether that is political power or wealth, the rules don't work the same for you anymore. And until that's leveled out, it's hard to say that we have had full accountability for something like the Capitol riot, because accountability has to be applied consistently. Otherwise, it requires the question of, well, who are these rules for if they're not for everyone?
The thing I'm so struck by, though, is this idea that these people are going to jail, some of them for a very long time. And whether or not they got direct orders, a lot of times we won't ever know, but they certainly consider themselves to be acting on the behest of these electives who told them things like, go out there and kick ass. Are you seeing anything where those people are like, we got screwed or no?
It kind of varies case to case. I've certainly seen a couple instances reported out in the press where people have sort of doubled down on their views, you know, believing the government was out to get them and destroy the world and punish Trump supporters and yada, yada, yada. It's just confirmation of their suspicions. And then other people, like I forget the fellow's name who testified during the January 6th committee hearings, kind of coming forward and expressing regret that he got caught up in the moment and that, you know, he fell for this lie that Trump was selling. You know, I think skeptics would ask how much of this is sort of a convenient defense that entertains prosecutors that would try to get more serious charges against them. You know, a little bit of like, oh, woe is me. Look at me. I'm so foolish. Whoops. Maybe there's a theory there that a defense would argue that to try to soften the strike that a prosecutor would try to lay down on them. But to some degree, I think it is kind of apparently true on its face, you know, if you're going to take an honest assessment of it. So, you know, like all things, I think it exists in probably some sort of gray area between absolutes.
We have the big kind of fight in MAGA world is between Ben Shapiro and Steven Crowder, and it involves $50 million and a contract.
Oh, yeah.
Discuss.
Working class hero, Steven Crowder.
Yes.
Turning his nose up at more money than I'll ever make in my life.
Any of us will ever make. I mean, $50 million. I mean, come on, man.
You know, it was this four-year contract. So the Daily Wire, I think the most public figure out of the Daily Wire is Ben Shapiro. It's run by this guy named Jeremy Boring, which is also a pretty great name for someone who runs something like the Daily Wire.
Right. But does this mean the rest of them are making $50 million?
That's what I wondered, too. Like, how much money is the Daily Wire really bringing in? And then, of course, where is it coming from? Because there's no way, even, you know, if you get the most devoted, like Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro fans to buy a coffee cup that says liberal tears on it, like, you could not sell enough of those to fund one $50 million contract, let alone what the rest of these guys are getting paid.
I mean, that's why I have a little bit of skepticism about this whole thing. And I wonder if maybe it was just the whole thing is bullshit. This group has not tended to be able to pull off something like that because they're not geniuses. But you could see a world where this was just sort of like, because remember, the Daily Wire is always doing things that sort of juice their numbers and make them seem more successful than they are.
Oh, yeah. The amount of money they dump into Facebook ads alone is just outrageous.
Yeah. Do you think there's a world in which this is just like a complete fake thing?
Maybe. That would be some pretty hardcore devotion to the bit, and I would have no choice but to respect it.
Yeah, me too.
You know, nominate these guys for Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, next year's big picture, whatever that award's called.
Yeah. I mean, just completely insane. So the other big controversy in MAGA world involves gas stoves. By the way, I have a gas stove, and it's obviously better to cook on than an electric stove, but I don't want my kids to get brain damage. So
in a very cathartic sense, I enjoy cooking on gas more.
I mean, everybody does, but in the same sense, it has become Ted Cruz was like, come and get it, right?
A tone that these guys usually reserve for like machine guns after schools full of children are killed. They're like, come and get my stove. And like, I had Amanda Moore on my podcast this week, and we talked a little bit about it. And, you know, she brought up the fact that, or I guess the question, like, when was the last time any of these guys cooked their own food?
Right.
I would like to know the answer to this. Those questions, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good call. I mean, I just have trouble imagining Ted Cruz cooking Heidi a nice dinner, but maybe, who knows? I mean, who am I to say that Ted is not a domestic god in his own home?
Yeah, what I was disappointed that I didn't see was like a mashup of cooking video nightmare clips where it's like the suburban mom being like, oh, I'm making a stuffed Doritos chicken breast parfait or something, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that sounds amazing.
You know, I wanted so bad to see one of these, like, come and take my gas stove guys to be like, you'll never stop this and cook one of those nightmare meals.
Yeah.
I figured it statistically, it just had to happen, but I haven't seen it yet.
It seems like it's coming. The one last question I have for you is, we're seeing a lot of like fracturing in MAGA world. For example, like this RNC fight, one of the candidates for RNC chair has both Never Trumpers and Charlie Kirk. I mean, we're seeing like a lot of strange bedfellows. We're seeing that in like candidates and in Congress, where you have people like Matt Gaetz fighting against people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, how is MAGA world dealing with this, or are they just taking it in stride?
For all the talks of infighting and how dramatic it may look on its face, it's pretty normal for political movements to do this during a period of transition. You know, I have observed the political right for most of my career, and they have done this every time. So like when Trump came into office, there was a big power jockey to say, you know, who was going to be the MAGA contingency in Congress, or,
right,
you know, what think tank was going to represent the Trump train of thought. In the same sense that happened when he came into office and people started, you know, jockeying for power for themselves, it also, I think, kind of makes sense that, you know, as Trump leaves office and is in the public spotlight less, that the people that had obtained power in that way, or people that were seeking power in that way, would sort of do a heel turn, or not a heel turn, but like a pivot, and try to solidify some of that power, or try to exert that power in a way that cements the status that they may have been able to accomplish for themselves in that era. So I don't think it's terribly unusual. I don't think it's going to like rip the place to the ground. I am curious this year to see, though, if Trump is able, you know, if he does come back online and, you know, manages to grab the news headlines every day, will he, after everything, be able to reemerge as the leader of the GOP? And I think he still is kind of the de facto leader, but he's not in public life as much anymore. Or will someone sense a vacuum there and try to step into that vacuum? The power struggle at the very top, I think, is going to be the most interesting, because over the last 5 or 6 years, the GOP has kind of rearranged itself into the Trump party. And if there's something after Trump, you know, in the near future, at least, I'll be really curious to see what that looks like.
Yeah, me too. I mean, curious and also depressed.
Horrified, yeah.
Jared Holt, I hope you will come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Congressman Ruben Gallego represents Arizona's 3rd District and is running for the United States Senate in Arizona. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Ruben Gallego.
Hi, how you doing?
Do you have something to tell us? Do you have something to announce?
I'm having a baby girl July 8th.
Oh my God, congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm running for Senate for Arizona.
Wait. I'm back to the baby girl. This will be your second kid. You're running for Senate in Arizona. Talk to us about why you decided to run against the worst person in the world.
I wouldn't go that far.
Was it the performance at Davos?
No. Look, I'm a very lucky man, Molly. I've told you about my background. I'm very appreciative of everything this country has given me. I'm not even supposed to be here in many senses of the word. But because of, you know, hard work, my support from my family, support from teachers, support from the crazy, weird government that people are all afraid of, I was actually able to live the American dream, and I'm still able to live the American dream. And I feel that there's people that are still, you know, want to believe in that, but you need to actually have, you know, people that back them, people that actually fight for them, and people that actually will go to sea to fight for them. And let me tell you what. Sinema is not doing that. And she has not done that for a while. And there's no way that, you know, she's inspiring people to even believe in any way that she is there to fight for the little people and not for, you know, the big money interests.
I was thinking about that video of her at Davos wearing a fur vest or maybe a bath mat, that where she was bragging about keeping the filibuster and her work doing that. Could the people of Arizona ever benefit from keeping the filibuster?
No, because the filibuster really has become a tool of obstruction. And like, let's just go back to Davos, right? Is there a problem with her being Davos? Maybe not necessarily, right? I've never been to Davos, don't quite understand what it is, but that's fine. You were high-fiving Manchin for using the filibuster to kill the Voting Rights Act on MLK weekend. She wasn't in Arizona. She wasn't in all the MLK events that we have. And Martin Luther King weekend. It's extremely important in Arizona because we actually have, unfortunately, not a great history with Martin Luther King weekend in Arizona. We got boycotted for many years because we wouldn't pass it. It was just a lot of bad things. And, you know, Sinema decides to, number one, skip MLK weekend again, which I think she has for many years, but then to high five killing the Voting Rights Act, named after her so-called, like who she calls her friend, John Lewis, using a, you know, Civil War era rule. This is just ridiculous. All that being said, I think she actually gives more and more reasons all the time for this type of campaign.
Yeah, I want to ask you about this because some of the criticism I saw was like, well, someone who's on the left can't beat Sinema, but Sinema actually ran as a very lefty candidate.
I mean, the problem is that Sinema can't win.
Right.
She can run. And if I step out and for some weird reason don't run, she's still going to lose because she's alienated everybody because nobody trusts her in Arizona.
Yeah, she's terrible.
She's taken some horrible positions and she has really decided to back some of the kind of not the best entities in the country. When it was the time for us to negotiate lower drug prices, instead of saying, I'm going to go help negotiate lower drug prices, she went to negotiate on behalf of the pharmaceutical lobby, which, by the way, they have a lot of lobbyists on Capitol Hill. They don't need one more that's paid by tax dollars. You know, when it was time to like try to pass, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, and it looked like the, you know, ultra rich and private equity and hedge funds were about to get taxed a little more, she, you know, held up the bill until there was a carve out for this really small population of people that mostly don't live in Arizona. So she has broken the trust with the voters of Arizona, and it's not coming back. And it doesn't matter what she changes to. She could change to Republican tomorrow. She's still not going to be successful.
I mean, she basically is a Republican, though, at this point.
I don't know. I think at least Republicans have some moral values that they'll stick to.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't go that far. But I do think it is interesting. The polling shows that you definitely have a path and that actually Sinema really takes from Republican voters as much as she takes liberal voters at this point.
I mean, our polling shows that she will take more from Republicans than Democrats. And also, once we run a full campaign where people all across Arizona get to know my story, my history, my dedication to service to this country, I think we're going to actually be able to hold a lot more Democrats than she's going to be able to take in terms of, and she'll end up taking more Republicans in the end.
You're in this very interesting place. You're a young congressperson. You're ambitious. I mean, explain to us sort of what you think you could be doing for Arizona when you get to the Senate.
I think the most important thing you can do, and, you know, I'm not anything special, is to just be a servant and just listen to your constituents. And actually open your ears and go to places that sometimes you maybe are not even wanted.
Right.
And go to meetings where you need to hear why people maybe are disagreeing with you. Or at least go to any meeting and have a public meeting like Sinema hasn't had in the last 3 to 4 years and explain why you are taking your position. So at a minimum, what I am doing is I'm going to be a representative of Arizona that's going to be available, number one. But number two, I do have an experience and background that I cannot let go. It is part of who I am. I grew up poor. I worked hard. I've lived the American dream. You know, I've served my country. You know, I saw some hard times in combat. I am, you know, a survivor of a survivor and thriver of PTSD. Those experiences make me who I am. And I cannot go to the Senate and deny that. And I think that sometimes we need people like that. We don't need necessarily all these perfect people that don't remember, you know, how it feels to struggle, how it feels to figure out, you know, whether you're going to be able to pay your grocery bill this month or your utility bill, or can you pay your car bill and your mortgage the same month? I understand that. And as a matter of fact, millions of Americans understand that. Unfortunately, a lot of politicians don't understand that. And when they are operating in the Senate, they think more of the, you know, top 1% first than they do of the, you know, the bottom, you know, 25% of this country.
It is incredibly weird because Kyrsten Sinema was like very, I mean, just the what's happened to her. She also came from a very poor family, but she had this kind of strange lobbyist meltdown. But anyway, one of the things you did serve just, and I saw that you're actually close friends with my favorite Jason Kander. And I was happy to see that. And you're both young veterans. How do you think that will help you? I mean, a lot of the Senate is about making decisions like that. How do you think your experience in the Iraq War and will affect that?
Look, I think I was not an officer in the Iraq War. I was enlisted. And not only was I enlisted, I wasn't even a high enlisted. I was basically as low as you can get in terms of rank. You know, my job was to be a rifleman. And not only that, I had to carry extra ammo and barrels for the machine gunner. That's what I did. And, you know, I didn't complain. I did my job. I thought I did my job well and everything that came with it. One of the things I do now in Congress is that I bring the perspective of that man or woman at that rank. Because right. When all these generals and all these like big, you know, policy thinkers are thinking about war, they think about it from the level of a general or a colonel or something like that. When in fact, most of the time, everything that happens starts with a very scared 18 or 19 year old man or woman, you know, having to do the first move.
Right.
And I've been in those situations. And I want to make sure that people remember that when we start making some very heavy decisions when it comes to our military personnel. And I certainly have done that in Congress, in the House of Representatives, and I'm going to do that in the Senate also.
You also, I mean, when you're in those lower ranks, you're more likely to get killed, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, that's the, you know, 1/3 of everybody in my company was either killed or wounded. That's unfortunately, that sometimes happens.
The thing I was struck by with your story was you raised your siblings, you had a single mother. I was also, you know, I mean, I just wonder, you know, how that informs your Senate candidacy and later career.
Raising children when you're a teenager is not an easy thing because you yourself are a child. I had to grow up very quickly. I had an after-school job. I also had to be a role model to my sisters. And I also, at some point, had to be a teenager and yeah. actually, whatever that experience is. And something I had to give. And so I gave up, I think, my teenage life in order to be something for my family. It showed me one thing more than anything else, that in order for you to be a leader, you have to sacrifice. And I did it, and I probably did it for my family, and my family, I feel, is better off because of that. It also taught me a lot about, you know, being accountable. You know, when you're doing these types of, when you're a leader in your family, when you're a leader in your community, when you're a leader in anything, you also have to realize that it's not a title that's given. It's something that's earned. You know, I had to learn early on that my sisters weren't going to respect me, weren't going to listen to me if I wasn't going to be a good role model to them. And the same thing holds with anything in politics. Like, people aren't going to respect you. People aren't going to follow you. People aren't going to try to work with you if they don't, at a core, trust who you are and you haven't earned that.
But enough about Kevin McCarthy. I want to ask you, you are in Congress right now. How is George Santos? What is he like? What's he up to?
Oh, good old Jorge.
I mean, what is happening? Do people hang out with him?
You know, Jorge lives, because he sleeps in his office, I'm sure, like the other Republicans.
Right.
His office is next door to mine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm definitely coming to visit you. Wait. So have you hung out with him at all? Seen him on the...
Oh, yeah. So we our office, we share an internal door, like, you know, oh, like in the hotels.
Oh, my God.
But I open the door and I like kind of go out and hang out with him a little bit and like have a little coffee to see how he's doing. We talk about all his multiple personalities, all his multiple jobs.
Do you really know, have a door in your office?
I ask him for like some stock tips since he used to work at JP Morgan. Oh, yeah, it's great. It's great.
do you really have a door?
We really actually do have a door between our office and their office, but we don't open it because, you know, our offices were set up as different offices. But I guess we could at some point for, you know, shits and giggles, as I used to say.
That is terrifying. What do you want our listeners to know about you? You know, that is sort of like, I mean, I feel like I know you and I don't really know you, but
that hurts.
I mean, I met you like a few times, but I always feel like I know you because you're just like very personable. But I mean, what do you want our listeners to know about you?
Look, I am who I am, and I, you know, I have my rough edges, but you always get the straight answer from me. And I'm always going to be fighting for the little guy. sometimes that gets you in trouble. Sometimes people don't want someone that's just there for the little guy. But I know where I'm going and I know what I want to do, but I need help. So, you know, people that want to help me out, please go to GallegoForArizona.com and give us help, because we're not going to be getting donations from the hedge fund managers. We're not going to get donations from private equity. We're going to really rely on like a lot of $1 donors.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, Ruben, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Keep inviting me back. I will come back.
I know you, our dear listeners, are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Jay Willis is the editor of Balls and Strikes. Welcome to Fast Politics, or welcome back. I don't fucking know. Jay Willis from Balls and Strikes, talk to us.
Leave all of this in. This is great.
Yeah. He leaves in some of this stuff that really, I sound like an idiot, but it's okay. That's my brand. So we're all right. Look forward to this being played at the RNC. I am here to talk to you about Beto O'Rourke and a very interesting case that involves dark money and Greg Abbott. Discuss.
Yeah, that's like we're 3/5 of the way to our Fox News bingo right there.
Yeah, let's hear it, baby.
Yeah, so this is a story of Beto O'Rourke and, as I understand, his close personal friend, Kelsey Warren. Kelsey is one of these like mega rich cartoonish Texas oil and gas guys.
Yeah.
Who donated a cool $1 million to Greg Abbott's gubernatorial campaign in 2021, in which Abbott, the incumbent, beat, should we say, former Texas congressman and noted election losing enthusiast, yeah, Beto O'Rourke.
By the way, pipeline billionaire is having fun with oil bust. And then there's a picture of him with a shovel. Yes, continue. Yes.
The $1 million to Greg Abbott is Kelsey Warren's largest donation in a state, in a Texas political race. Biggest check he's ever written. And you got to remember, just before we get to Beto, that this election is happening in the long tail of the 2021 power crisis in Texas. If Ted Cruz flying to Cancun during a pandemic while his constituents are freezing to death rings any bells, that's the story we're talking about here.
Oh, wait. So he wants to sue Beto for Beto's making Ted Cruz fly out of Cancun.
I wouldn't put logic like that past Greg Abbott.
Right. How dare Beto do that?
But no, not quite. But that's like an important part of the background here. So that that power crisis, Greg Abbott and other Republicans, they blamed that on, if memory serves, wind turbines. The actual culprits for that were the results of sort of all of the policies Republicans know and love, dependence on oil and gas, deregulation of those industries in Texas, and the failure to invest in climate change prep because you don't believe in it. So here's where Beto comes in, and I want to shout out the reporting of Jordan Yule, who wrote about this on his Substack. His Substack is called I Hate It Here and Never Want to Leave, which is a great title. And also, I'm getting that tattooed on my face once we're done recording.
Yeah. You'll never regret a face tattoo.
Never. That's what I hear. So Warren's big donation to Greg Abbott comes 2 weeks after Greg Abbott signs a law with a provision that lets fossil fuels companies like Warren's out of certain winterization requirements.
Yeah, they don't need it.
What recent events would prompt us to think that those might be important?
Yeah, absolutely none. And certainly not that frozen power grid where all those people froze to death in Texas.
Right. So Beto, on the campaign trail, he, of course, cuts an ad where he talks about the Abbott tax, which is what he refers to as increases in utility bills that he associated with Greg Abbott's policy. And the key line, and I'm quoting here from the ad, "The profiteers who made billions off of grid failure are being allowed to hike your bills by a governor who they gave millions." He's implying that Kelsey's $1 million donation was in exchange for or in recognition of the winterization exemption.
Right.
Now, like, maybe you already spotted the egregious and frankly offensive error in Beto's ad. Right. A governor who they gave millions. Obviously, that should be whom, because governor is the object of the sentence.
right, exactly.
Not the subject.
Thank you for clearing that up. No wonder that explains why he didn't win.
I agree.
Because Texans are a stickler for grammar.
Famously high up on that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Kelsey Warren, he was upset about something else. He said that Beto, by cutting this ad, had accused him of bribery, corruption, and extortion based on his, and again, I will quote here, perfectly legal campaign contribution to the candidate of his choosing, end quote. He says that this caused him mental anguish, and he is suing Beto O'Rourke for the contents of this campaign ad. Now, I want to be a little careful here because I don't want Kelsey Warren giving this podcast like the full Peter Thiel treatment.
Yeah, me too. I don't want you to get sued. But if you do get sued, I plan to take the other guys. No, I'm just kidding. Go on.
So First Amendment lawyers will refer to lawsuits like this as SLAPs, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And the goal is not really to like win, but to discourage people like Beto from public criticism by making them afraid of getting dragged into court for God knows how many years and God knows at what price. Now, because there is this thing called the First Amendment, many states have enacted laws that actually just limit your ability to, not to file slaps, I guess, but to make them as punitive as they're intended to be. There's procedural outs. You can, you know, file a motion to dismiss or a motion to strike and say, look, Your Honor, this is a matter of public concern. Like, this is speech. This shouldn't go any further. But if you're listening to this and you think, I'm sorry, Beto's getting sued over a campaign ad and you think this is objectively like batshit insane, like that's correct. Like, yes. Candidates say all kinds of shit on the campaign trail. Many, like usually, frankly, with far less factual support than Beto had here. Like, we're at a point right now where Donald Trump is getting ready to run for president again. If we're going to allow candidates to sue other candidates for falsehoods in campaign ads, like, Trump is going to be broke by Labor Day. Like, this is not tenable. I also want to put this talk about the broader political and cultural context, because this case really unites two sort of through lines of conservative thought. First, the idea that money is speech, right? That's how we get Citizens United, which dealt with federal campaign finance reform that equated money with speech under the First Amendment. That's how we get cases like Ted Cruz v. FEC, a more recent Supreme Court case that makes it easier to effectively bribe politicians. That's how we get cases like McDonald v. United States. I think that case is 7 years old now. Which narrowed the scope of what bribery of a public official means in the first place.
Right.
It's a line of thinking that gives very rich people the chance to basically infuse as much of their money as they want into the political process.
Right.
But the second thing conservatives love is the idea that there should be no consequences for speech. Money is speech and no consequences for speech. Citizens United fueled the rise of dark money, the political spending where the spender doesn't have to identify themselves. I also think it just sort of underlies the entire right-wing reaction to cancel culture, right? The idea that speech is only quote-unquote free if the speaker suffers no consequences for it. So this case combines these two dynamics. Money is speech, Kelsey Warren is exercising his First Amendment rights, and the government can't stop him. If you're wondering, how did this guy donate $1 million to a single political candidate? Doesn't that violate some kind of campaign finance limit? Joke's on you, Texas doesn't have any.
I would hope not.
Yeah. But also, the message of this case is that your speech, speaking about people who speak with their very thick wallets, might end up landing you in court. And Jordan Yule has a great quote that he pulls from Kelsey Warren's lawyer, quote, "He wrote that check in private, if he even wrote it himself," end quote. And the idea that the fact that Kelsey Warren wrote the check in private is somehow like important or dispositive here, I think just speaks to the detachment of rich people from politics and the sense of entitlement that they carry. It's like money allows us The Supreme Court has said that money allows us an outsized influence on the political process. And also that we deserve that. We deserve to be able to do that without having people say mean things about us.
Will Beto end up getting sued? Where do you think this goes?
So my understanding is Justin Miller at the Texas Observer, incidentally, has done like great reporting on this. My understanding is that it's still winding its way through Texas courts. And like Beto's got money, right? Because he raised a ton of money and lost again for the third time. But he raised a ton of money.
Right.
He can defend himself.
He can fight this. Yeah.
But like not everyone who's going to get hit with a slap has this kind of money, right? And that is how slaps succeed. If everyone has in the back of their mind the nagging possibility of getting dragged to court over some bullshit, you're just going to find something different to talk about. You're not going to take the risk. And then the wealthiest people with the means and the motive to influence politics can do so just a little more confident that no one's going to say anything about it.
This feels like a pretty good example of the Donald Trump school of law.
I share those concerns about just like the use of the court system by the right as a shield against what they would perceive as the excesses of cancel culture.
Right.
And like heavy use of scare quotes there, right? Because the key characteristic of cancel culture is that the people who complain about it almost never actually suffer any material harms other than like a couple of headlines that make them feel bad about themselves.
Right.
But we're at a point right now where the reaction to cancel culture is maybe like the single most important issue for Republican voters. And if politicians like seize on this strategy to try and silence their political opponents, like things are going to get nasty pretty quick.
So the Supreme Court found themselves not guilty of the leak. Really? I mean, ultimately, wasn't that? I mean, I guess they did exonerate some of the clerks who had been targeted by right-wing media, right?
Yeah, I think even saying that the court found themselves not guilty is kind of more generous than the court deserves, because they didn't even like investigate themselves and the potential.
Right. None of the justices or their spouses had to sign affidavits. Right.
Right. So background here is last year, before the Dobbs opinion that overturned Roe v. Wade, before Dobbs was published, there was a leak that was published in Politico of the draft opinion from Justice Alito. It turned out to be nearly identical to the one that the court published a couple of months later. And this is like more or less unprecedented, the combination of high profile case, leak from the court, and leak not just of like, you know, sources say X, but of a 70 page PDF that basically has not happened. I mean, that has not happened. I certainly cannot think of anything on this scale. So the court immediately announced like an investigation into it. And the person tasked with performing this information was the Supreme Court Marshal, Gail Curley, who, as I understand, is like a well-respected military lawyer. All due respect to Gail Curley, like her primary job is shouting or crying, as it's called, oye, 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 when the Supreme Court comes into session.
I wonder, is that a high-paying job? No, anyway, go on, yes.
I bet it's a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
The point is that, like, if you're actually trying to do an investigation, like, this is not FBI, CIA-level type shit. So the results of this report were published last week, and they were inconclusive. They said, we cannot figure out who the leaker was. But there are two main takeaways from it, I think. The first one is that, yeah, as you mentioned, the report talks about the sort of the gauntlet that court employees, clerks were subjected to. They sat for interviews. They had to sit. They had to swear that they, you know, didn't do the leak, didn't know anyone who did the leak. Some of them had their phones examined, all of that good stuff. The justices, by contrast, did not have to do that stuff. The marshal said in a follow-up statement that they had talked to the justices, you know, interviewed the justices, but the investigation had focused all along on the assumption that a Supreme Court employee or clerk, something to that effect, someone who's not a justice, had done the leak, which in the wake of a credibly sourced on-the-record story talking about Justice Samuel Alito's alleged history of leaking opinions, like, I don't know who did it, but but not investigating the justices at all just speaks to how sort of how differently they are treated like royalty compared to everyone else, not just in the country, right? But in their own place of work, they're considered above suspicion. And if a justice did do it, like, how are we ever going to know about it? Because nobody's looking that way.
Just about the lameness we would expect. Jay, thank you so much. This is so interesting, and I really appreciate having you.
My pleasure. Good to talk.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Molly Jong-Fast.
Jesse Cannon.
Mike Pompeo, that forgettable guy with no charisma, has lost a lot of weight for his book tour, and now he needs attention.
So Mike Pompeo lost a lot of weight, probably running for president, and during this book tour has done the sort of most craven, attention-seeking thing he can, which is he's going, first of all, he blurbed his own book. So for that alone, blurbing his own book is a non-starter. I guess he assumed there was no one more fabulous than him to blurb his own book. But he gave this little nugget, which he wrote in the book, Never Give an Inch, Fighting for the America I Love. He didn't deserve to die, but we need to be clear about who he was. The he we're talking about is Jamal Khashoggi, an opinion journalist for The Washington Post, pretty famous guy. I want to read this again. He didn't deserve to die, but we need to be clear about who he was. And too many in the media were not. By the way, what? Like, MBS, a murderous psychopath, killed an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. And somehow this is the guy who got murdered's fault. Pompeo, who served as CIA director in the Trump administration, God knows what he did when he was there, described Khashoggi as an activist, claiming that he was a journalist only to the extent that I and many other public figures are journalists. So the guy, I don't think he knows what opinion journalism is, but either way, Khashoggi shouldn't have had an opinion and he shouldn't have worn that short skirt. And I'm just going to say Mike Pompeo is trying to peddle outrage in the hopes that it will sell books. But I have news for Mike Pompeo. No one is interested in his book and he's still polling at like 1%.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.